and welcome to my hearth. Today I'm going to do something completely different. And that is, I'm actually going to look at a piece of text and try and see why it is so brilliant. I've already talked about Wilkie Collins and his friendship with Charles Dickens in the previous episode, but I wanted to speak about what makes him so special as a writer. Before we start, there are several things I wanted to point out. First of all, remembering that this work was published in episodic form, i.e. it was published in a magazine, and so had to engage the reader from the very beginning and make them want to buy the next magazine to read the next episode. So in other words, what techniques and devices does Wilkie Collins use to get the reader hooked? I'm going to look at what is described as chapter one. Now, in fact, this is not the first chapter in the book. There is a prologue which tells the story of a very difficult soldier in the Indian Army who steals a diamond, the moonstone, from a statue in India. That is already going to be interesting to a Victorian audience. They loved what they called the exotic, the love of the Oriental, the fascination with India. It was a place which Queen Victoria was to describe as the jewel in the crown of her empire. She eventually named herself as Empress of India. You can see the legend Ind Imp on all the coinage of the time, right from Queen Victoria's reign, right up until India found independence in 1947. So we have already got something to hook the reader in. The mystery and fascination of a fabulous jewel. A jewel which is not only beautiful, but has religious significance. Then we come to the story itself. The events related by Gabriel Betteridge, house steward in the service of Julia, Lady Verinder. Chapter 1. In the first part of Robinson Crusoe, at page 129, you will find it thus written. Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Only yesterday I opened my Robinson Crusoe at that place. Only this morning, May 21st, 1850, came my lady's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, and held a short conversation with me as follows. Betteridge, says Mr. Franklin, I have been to the lawyers about some family matters, and among other things we have been talking of the loss of the Indian diamond in my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years since. Mr. Brough thinks, as I think, that the whole story ought, in the interests of truth, to be placed on record in writing, and the sooner the better. Not perceiving his drift yet, and thinking it always desirable, for the sake of peace and quietness, to be on the lawyer's side, I said I thought so too, Mr. Franklin went on. In this matter of the diamond, he said, the characters of innocent people have suffered under suspicion already, as you know. The memories of innocent people may suffer hereafter for want of a record of the facts to which those who come after us can appeal. There can be no doubt that this strange family story of ours ought to be told, and I think, Betteridge, Mr. Brough and I together have hit on the right way of telling it. Very satisfactory to both of them, no doubt. But I fail to see what I myself had to do with it so far. We have certain events to relate, Mr. Franklin proceeded, and we have certain persons concerned in those events who are capable of relating them. Starting from these plain facts, the idea is that we should all write the story of the Moonstone in turn, as far as our own personal experience extends, and no farther. We must begin by showing how the diamond first fell into the hands of my Uncle Herncastle, when he was serving in India 50 years since. This prefatory narrative I have already got by me in the form of an old family paper, which relates the necessary particulars on the authority of an eyewitness. The next thing to do is to tell how the diamond found its way into my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years ago, and how it came to be lost in little more than 12 hours afterwards. Nobody knows as much as you do, Betteridge, about what went on in the house at the time, so you must take the pen in hand and start the story. In those terms, I was informed about what my personal concern was with the matter of the diamond. If you were curious to know what course I took under the circumstances, I beg to inform you that I did what you would probably have done in my place. I modestly declared myself to be quite unequal to the task imposed upon me, and I privately felt, all the time, that I was quite clever enough to perform it, if I only gave my own abilities a fair chance. Mr. Franklin, I imagine, must have seen my private sentiments in my face. He declined to believe in my modesty, and he insisted on giving my abilities a fair chance. 2 hours have passed since Mr. Franklin left me. As soon as his back was turned, I went to my writing desk to start the story. There I have sat helpless, in spite of my abilities, ever since, seeing what Robinson Crusoe saw, as quoted above, namely, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Please to remember, I opened the book by accident at that bit, only the day before I rashly undertook the business now in hand. And allow me to ask, if that isn't prophecy, what is? I am not superstitious. I've read a heap of books in my time. I'm a scholar in my own way. Though turned 70, I possess an active memory and legs to correspond. You are not to take it, if you please, as the saying of an ignorant man, when I express my opinion that such a book as Robinson Crusoe never was written, and never will be written again. I have tried that book for years, generally in combination with a pipe of tobacco, and I found it my friend in need in all the necessities of this mortal life. When my spirits are bad, Robinson Crusoe. When I want advice, Robinson Crusoe. In past times when my wife played me, in present times I have had a drop too much, Robinson Crusoe. I have worn out 6 stout Robinson Crusoes with hard work in my service. On my lady's last birthday she gave me a 7th. I took a drop too much on the strength of it, and Robinson Crusoe put me right again. Price 4 shillings and 6pence, bound in blue, with a picture into the bargain. Still, this don't look much like starting the story of the diamond, does it? I seem to be wandering off in search of Lord knows what, Lord knows where. We will take a new sheet of paper, if you please, and begin over again, with my best respects to you. Right, it's genius, isn't it? So let's think, what are the things used to hook us in, to make us want to go on and read, month after month, quite a long and complicated story? First of all, there is a mystery. The diamond has gone missing, even after it's only just been in the house for a day. That of itself would be enough. It's the essence of a detective story. And in fact, the Moonstone is very often credited with being one of the first great detective stories. Secondly, the story is going to be told by witnesses to certain events, and they are going to, as it were, give evidence, tell their bit of the story, and just their bit. This is in the tradition of the great stories of what we sometimes call the epistolary stories, which are stories based on letters or even diary incidents, so that we follow the track of the story through the eyes of different people. It is like they are giving evidence to us, and we are acting as a detective. Always a great way of engaging the reader, because they become the expert. Only they have all the evidence and have to put it together. Then we start to be introduced to engaging characters. The first one is Gabriel himself. He writes as he speaks, so we get a real sense of the personality behind the character. He is talking directly to us. Moreover, he is a servant, a steward in a house, and we have always been fascinated by the idea of class and the idea of an intelligent servant. This goes right back to Roman comedy and the servant who sorts everything out, because they can see what's going on. They know what's happening in the servant quarters. They know what's happening in the quarters of the rich and famous. Now, with the genius of Wilkie Collins, there has to be an added extra. And in this sequence, it's the humour of Gabriel's relationship to Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe is literally his Bible. He reads it under all circumstances, and it gives him the answers to his questions. He treasures it as though it were a prophetic text. It answers him when he's sober, it answers him when he's drunk, it answers him when he's having trouble with his wife. As always with great writers, the devil is in the detail, and it's so important that Gabriel tells us that he's already worn out 6 copies of Robinson Crusoe, and that he's recently been given a new one with a picture in it. As a result, we love his dry humour and his wit. He is intelligent, and importantly, he's intelligent with words, which were so important to Victorian people. As the story of the Moonstone unfolds and we're introduced to other narrators, we understand the power of identifying with a writer. This is a great Victorian technique, and we really relish it in the works of Anthony Trollope and Charles Dickens, but especially with Wilkie Collins. The influence of the book was massive. It's often quoted that without the Moonstone, we wouldn't have had the great detective novels of Arthur Conan Doyle and everyone else that followed. There are very good adaptations of the Moonstone, which the BBC did, but of course, you lose the sheer delight of the prose style of Wilkie Collins and all the cleverness of the characters. I can also highly recommend the audible version of the book, which is narrated by Stephen Jeffries. You can also download the Kindle version for free. So please delight in it in whichever way you want. More next time.